Josh Reeves is with us from theglobalreality.com, and we're talking about his latest, The Lost Secrets of Ancient America, the first volume. Thank you for staying with us, joining us here in the members area, as we're going to continue now with more. And we are just scraping the surface. There are just, there's so many tentacles and so many tangents hinging on the story. Again, we're talking about the background of mankind itself, prehistory, the ancient world, what really was happening on this planet at that point. And it has to do with everything that is going on today. And there might be some people, so, you know, Josh, that ask themselves now then, all right, well, if this is a reality, why don't we know about this? Why is it not more talked about? There is an extensive cover-up going on here, primarily from the Smithsonian, actually, and they've been really instrumental in getting their people out on the scene early on in some of these archaeological digs and saying it's this or that or the other. But the question always is, what do they really know? What are they covering up? And why are they so afraid of this story getting out there, Josh? Let's try to get into this a little bit.
Well, that's a fantastic question. And it's one that was very heavy on my mind throughout the course of making this first volume of this film and doing all this research. And it's one that does indeed have its answer in a lot of things we've been talking about, you know, already that we talked about in the first hour. And at the core of it, Henrik, I think, in my opinion, based on the evidence and based on the research, I think that it has to do more than anything with the fact that it throws the entire timeline of history, both from a scientific point of view and also from a religious point of view, as far as creationists and this idea that the Earth is only 7,000 years old and all that. It really... all of this stuff, from the rock wall to any of these other ancient sites, this idea that, you know, Christopher Columbus discovered America and nobody else was here before that.
I mean, come on. Can we let that go now? I mean, even on the, and you show this in the film, of course, as well, but even the Scandinavians were here before that, for Christ's sake. Sure. That's more or less established now, you know, come on.
Sure. And that's another thing, too, that we have to also understand, Henrik, is that whether we're talking about, and this is a revelation to me, whether we're talking about Celts or whether we're talking about Scandinavians or whether we're talking about, Middle Eastern or Phoenicians, what we find more and more is that all of these things were all essentially the same people. They spread out throughout the world through diffusionism, and they had different names in the different areas that they inhabited in at different points in time. Yeah. And again, as far as why they want all this covered up, the main thing about it is that it completely throws, well, if you look at it from this idea of man was, created in the garden and this happened on this such and such time ago, and then you look at the archaeological evidence and you start seeing dating that runs in excess of, 200,000 years. I mean, we have voluminous amounts of artifacts that were found in soil stratas that date to 200,000 years. You have dating done at the rock wall that shows that a catastrophic event happened there sometime between, it was uncovered. The wall itself was uncovered, not covered by anything, somewhere between 20,000 and 200,000 years ago. And this is conclusive based on the soil analysis that's been done. On the overburden and the covering of it, and the data proves beyond any shadow of a doubt that a catastrophic event 12,000 years ago covered up this wall. So that's the thing you start to see, is that the reason why they are so scared of any of this coming out is because if you start to unravel, it's like a string, or you start to pull it a little bit, you pull a little bit more, and the whole thing falls apart. And I think that's what they're scared of, is because at the root of this, You have years and years and years of scientific data, years and years and years of history, religion, everything else turned upside down on its head, and the perception that creates in the mind of the individual who sees this information is, well, if that's true, then how can I believe any of this stuff that we've been told? And that's really the root of it. You really start to see that you really can't believe anything that we've been told about our history. It all seems like a watered down, convoluted version of itself. And what I found is a lot of this has to do, when you study the ancient texts, they talk about these people who were, they were giants. They talk about the giants being excised from the Middle East and from that area by the Hebrews, by the Jews, and how they essentially were deemed to have their any record of their existence wiped off the face of the earth and any memory of them basically thrown away and forgotten about. This is what was ordered when they destroyed King Og and a lot of the giants in the ancient Middle East. And then you had, of course, the exodus of the Jews and all that stuff. Mm. And so it seems to me that these artifacts that are found in the United States pertain specifically to these people that were essentially deemed to be stricken from the record, stricken from the history books, and forgotten about for religious reasons. And I think that that's where a lot of this comes from, is that these guys, well, specifically the Freemasons, like we talked about earlier, the Freemasons are a relatively new group historically.
Oh, I mean, sure.
They've only, you know, they haven't really been around, but the information and the knowledge that they have has been around since time immemorial.
Yeah.
And I think that that's one of the things specifically that they are afraid of, is they don't want people to find out their origins of this. I mean, these secret societies really, they've all just taken on different names and different characteristics for the years because, you know, if you're a young person, you're coming up and you want to join a group or a fraternity or something like that, there's this natural thing about being young, Henrik, where, you know, you don't want to have anything to do with what the fuddy-duddy old people had to do with before you. You know, you don't want to go join, for the most part, the same group that your father joined. So that's what they do. They change the names of these things, but the essence of them all goes back to this ancient knowledge that has to do with mathematics, building, sacred architecture, all of it. And that's one of the things that the Masons learn about in the craft, is they are able to see a structure, see a building, see anything, and glean information from that based on the mathematics, the building, everything that is encoded into that structure. And this is why the gentleman who initially looked at the rock wall immediately said this is not a natural structure, because they could see the mathematics and they could see the codes built into that rock wall that you see existing today in modern structures or ancient Gothic cathedrals throughout Europe and the rest of it.
Yeah, indeed. I recall a conversation with Christopher Knight about also the origins of some of the traditions for building, and he brought up the Norse connection. And again, it you know, what way did it go, so to speak? Was it an origin place from the Middle East somewhere that spread up in Europe? Was it the other way around? You know, all the details can be argued. We have sites up in Sweden, like the Kiviksgraven, which is a burial site where you have, you know, these omega signs and you know, Phoenician scripture.
Really?
Yeah, basically stuff like that. And I mean, so it could be argued where comes from what. I've found so many connections between northern Italy and Sweden in terms of rock carvings. They look pretty much identical. There is one tradition that talks about Norsemen actually going down and taking over the amber production down in northern Italy for a while, and hence also actually brought some of the construction knowledge and stuff like that. I mean, so again, back and forth that can be argued, but nonetheless, there have been communication between these groups. There have been sharing of knowledge. And then into this mix, as you brought in now, Josh, is this idea that there was also another race of giants, that at least partially some of them seems to have been, well, hunted around the earth, I would say then. I mean, I don't know else what to call it. If they came over to North America and, you know, regular mankind, so if you so will, got there a little bit late, and there seems to be a period where the evidence hasn't been covered up in the same way as it has been on other continents. Hence, we have so many stories of these giants in America. Is that how you think things unfolded, or do you have another take on that, Josh?
Well, I mean, here's what I've gathered from looking at the research myself, and I was, you know, I was quite confused about this in the beginning myself. It seems that there was, and you know this, you've probably read about this as well. There seems to be a remnant that was left over after the supposed fall of Atlantis. There seems to be a remnant of both humans and of the Atlanteans that survived the deluge and survived the catastrophe.
Yeah.
And some of these seem to be essentially just the reason they seem to be savagistic, and they seem to be, you know, just these brutes, is because everything they had, all their knowledge, everything was wiped out. And so when you had successive generations that survived and then would be born, essentially those next generations that would be born in places where maybe there used to be Atlantean strongholds, which would be all through North America, later on, when you had new generations born after the waters receded, they had nothing left. They had no knowledge. They had no books, nothing to give them any kind of a culture. So they gradually seem to have become a savage people. And it seems that there is definitely a connection, it describes this in the text, between these pre-flood Atlantean groups that existed in these cities throughout the world, and a connection to the people who later, after the floodwaters receded, came up on dry land in places like what we now know as Iraq and Babylon, Mesopotamia, and started to do what we described earlier all over again, and that was to seed the populations with knowledge and information. And it seems that it's just a big circle, Henrik. I mean, yeah. when you look at this, it started in one place, it went to another, there was a catastrophe, and then the whole thing cycled again.
Yeah.
And towards the end of the film, I show some maps and various things on the screen that give you an idea of how these migrations took place. And they took place almost exactly as you talked about earlier. You had a genesis point of these people that came out of the Middle East. They spread throughout Europe, throughout Asia, throughout Africa, and then eventually started heading west and going to western lands. We're talking 5,000-7,000 years ago. I mean, there's massive evidence of ancient copper mining going on in Michigan, where they pulled out hundreds of thousands of cubic yards of copper for years and years and years. That copper's been analyzed and has been found in artifacts from everywhere in the United States, in mound sites, to places in the Middle East, in Israel, in Iraq, everywhere. This copper was all over the place. And that's what is said in the ancient text, that these giants were ran out of the Middle East and that they fled back to their copper mines in the West. I mean, the ancient Mesopotamian texts state that explicitly. So that's what you see is, Henrik, is these people, after a slow diffusion in every area that they inhabited, intermingled and interbred with the indigenous populations, and it seems that this is how you started to have the rise of various different types of races and cultures and people. And it seems that not in every case these giants wouldn't produce giant offspring, but their giant DNA, which seems to be dormant in a lot of us, does seem to come out in the modern day in some species and some cultures of people. There's several pictures in my film of some Arab guys that are standing there with a regular guy, and these guys are like 9 feet tall. You've got the couple that lived in Ohio that were giants. They lived in the 1800s, early 1900s. So you start to see that the DNA evidence completely supports, and I've got clips in the film of that, this idea that this diffusionism was going on. But not only were they diffusing their culture and their knowledge, but also they were changing the bloodlines and setting up these indigenous populations. The one of the startling things for me, and one of the biggest revelations of all of this work for the film, was the DNA evidence pertaining to the Hopewell Mound Builders and the Cherokee. And the Cherokee believe up and down the wall that they have Jewish ancestry. And it's really a misnomer that they have Jewish ancestry, because they have a Semitic ancestry. And that's what people forget, is you can have people who are Jewish or Arabic or, Islamic, Muslim, but they're all a Sephardic people.
Same DNA.
Same DNA. And a lot of this DNA, they found, specifically there's a clip in the film where they trace all of this Cherokee and Hopewell Mound Builder DNA back to one specific place, and that is the hills of Galilee. And if you look at the hills where the hills of Galilee are located, I have a map in the film that shows it, that was considered Amorite territory, the giant territory, during that time. So it's fascinating. People who thought they had Indian descent or thought they had Jewish descent all seem to have this European ancestry that also goes back to, it's like a European ancestry, but it also goes back to areas in the Middle East. It's completely confusing to people because we tend to think of things in the geopolitical strata that we know of them in the modern day.
Exactly.
You know what I mean? So that's one of the things that's confusing about it. But the DNA evidence shows beyond any shadow of a doubt that this specific type of DNA, King Tutankhamun had this DNA as well, was started in that area and did diffuse throughout the world. But because the people who it originated with were wiped out, there's one story in particular in the film I have that was taken from an Ohio newspaper, I think in the late 1800s, and they actually interviewed this Indian man about this massive graveyard of giant skeletons they found in Ohio. And when they asked him about that, he said, "Oh, we don't go near there. That was here long before the red man was here." And when they went and dug all this up, they just found it was a graveyard of redheaded giants. So that's the other thing that you start to see is you know, a lot of these earthworks and a lot of these things that have been associated with Native Americans, the Native Americans throw their hands up and say, "We didn't do that.
We didn't do it. Yeah,
that was here before us."
And how often doesn't that take place? I'm thinking about the Incas and there's so many others. I mean, just look at some of the structures in South America, the way they've been built up on you know, hillsides and up the mountains, way, way, way up there, and just thinking of dragging stones up there with the tools accessible.
Oh, there's no way.
At the time, even if they had big machines like we have today, I mean, you can't do it. It's impossible. Something else did this.
That's absolutely the case, and that's one of the things that, again, with the rock wall that I started trying to collate between various different sites, like, all the ones in South America, like Machu Picchu and Sacsayhuaman and all these different sites where you have all these stones that appear to be, a lot of these stones seem to be, some of them seem to be cut stones and some of them don't. Some of them seem to be just jointed stones that were fit together. But the interesting thing about the rock wall stones is that they are absolutely a cast stone. These were made of materials that were brought together and then cast to make the individual stones of the wall. And that's another interesting thing I want to point out about the rock wall to people is that it has a mean elevation of 550 feet above sea level, meaning this entire 20-mile in diameter structure was leveled by someone at 550 feet, meaning that the structure itself does not change as the terrain of the land changes. Once you get down to the bottom of where it is, it's mean at 550 feet above sea level. And if I could, I wanted to give people some of the information on what's contained in these stones, Henrik.
Sure.
You have 55% zircon, 17% garnet, 13% tourmaline, 2% rutile, 2% starlight, 10% titanite, and 1% brookite. And then there's also several others that have been found. It's all in the film. But the interesting thing about it is that these are all rare earth metals. They never exist, specifically brookite and titanite. That's the key thing. You never find titanite and brookite together naturally in nature. And the reason you don't is because titanite and brookite together make titanium. And when you want to make titanium, you have to go to an area over here and get titanite. You have to go over here and get brookite. You mix them together, then you make titanium. In the rock wall, they are found together. In the rock wall stones, and this is the most interesting thing about it, their molecular structure, normally when you would take these types of minerals and you would mix them in a soup, their molecular structures would always, in every case, bond together and basically create one individual set of bonding structures. In this, you don't have that case. They are somehow, by some technology we're not aware of, these stones... makeup and material, each one of these aforementioned minerals that I talked about here are separately in the stones. Their molecular structure has not bonded together with the other. They have somehow remained independent in the stone structure. And what's interesting is that they are held together with what they call a geopolymer material that is made out of three different types of crystals that are brought together. And when you expose this stuff to air, when John Lindsay was pulling out these stones from the wall, when you would expose them to the air, you could actually see after about a couple of days where the crystal starts to grow as it's exposed to air. It's absolutely waterproof. It's absolutely indestructible. It has a hardness almost on the scale of more scale of a diamond. A diamond is 10. The rock wall is an 8. And that is because of these heavy, heavy minerals. So my thing about it was, I said, well, okay, here's the minerals. Here's what we have it's made up of. These are not normally found in this part of the world naturally ever. So, you know, where would someone find these materials? Where would you go to find all of this stuff? So I started looking and searching for that. And lo and behold, I came across this mention of a place called Beringer Hill, which is about a couple hours or south of Dallas, where I live, near Austin, Texas, about an hour from Austin, and was just completely blown away. I'd never heard of this spot. You had Westinghouse and Edison there back when they found out it, trying to get their paws on it. You know, of course, they're famous for stealing Tesla's technologies and selling them to J.P. Morgan. And it's very interesting that this Sumerian king list that I mentioned at the end of the film as well was also in the possession of J.P. Morgan for a period of time. So those two things really made me say, okay, you know, when I start to see the big bankers interested in this stuff, combined with the Freemasons and everything else, it can't be an accident. And so I set out to find out, okay, you know, is this where the material for the rock wall was quarried at? And come to find out, at this area they call the Llano Uplift in South Central Texas, it has every single material that is made up in the rock wall stones found there in abundance, as well as thousands of other rare earth minerals and metals that have never been found anywhere else on the planet, some of which are radioactive. And then later found out that they found a similar 20-mile in diameter structure only about 100 miles from here, where they had furnaces and an altar room with altars on it that were found. That's another thing I want to try to investigate more in the future. But it was just people will see all this detail in the film, so I'm only giving you really the short of it here. But the fact of the matter is, I now have the pretty substantial solid evidence of where the quarry for the rock wall stones is found, where that area came from. The biggest thing about the rock wall that was one of the anomalies with these rocks and stones was the piezoelectrical makeup of the wall, and also the strange high-level electromagnetic field signature. Now, this is not the same as, you know, you pick up a magnet and the other end attracts another magnet and that's all good, or it attracts iron filings. None of the rock wall stones actually do that. But if you put a magnetic Gauss meter on the rock wall, it measures somewhere around 40 Gauss, which when you look at Earth as prime magnetizer, Earth generally has a Gauss reading about 0.5. So for this thing to have this massive amounts of electromagnetic field to it was really startling. And some of the stones that I brought back from that area where I thought the quarry is low, where I think the quarry is located, I have a little, I don't have any sophisticated equipment yet to do all this. So I have actually have a Gauss meter on my iPad. So I took the iPad because it has a magnet in it and it's able to get some rudimentary readings. And some of the stones that I was analyzing from that area of the Llano Uplift were giving me a 40 to 50 Gauss magnetic field, but they wouldn't give me that on any other rocks or stones or anything I put it up against. So I don't want to say conclusively that the stones from this area that I analyzed have the same magnetic Gauss reading as the rock wall, but over the further analysis, I think we'll be able to determine that. But just the fact that it's showing in that target range with just a rudimentary check is very interesting.
Indeed. Well, this seems to be a common property on a lot of these stones, either, well, if they're put together, as you say, as well, geopolymer. That's very interesting. Sounds a little bit like the theories about the reconstituted limestone that people like Joseph Davidovits talks about, on specifically when it comes to the stones of the Great Pyramid, that they're in some way molded together to have, you know, a specific property. But, okay, well, that's interesting. So there's no real quarry in that sense that they've taken the stones to build the rock wall with. It's put together. What about the knowledge of DNA and the chromosomes? You have a section about this in the film that's very interesting and goes a little bit more into the actual symbolism, a lot of things that you've discovered on these sites as well. Talk a little bit about that, Josh.
Well, that was the whole genesis for a lot of this stuff. I didn't set out in making this film to try and prove this thing to be something I wanted it to be. I strictly was trying to come at this from the example of, from the standpoint of being somebody who was new to this. So one of the sites that I visited, one of the mound sites I visited was a place called Spiral Mounds in Oklahoma, and it's the only open Native American park to the public in the state of Oklahoma, even though there are many. And this site I really wanted to visit because I was reading about the stories of all these strange artifacts they had. They found a tablet with Syrian writing on it near this site. They found a conch shell with it's the damnedest thing. It just really blew my mind. It still blows my mind thinking about it. This thousands of year old artifact with a serpent in the shape of a swastika,
yeah,
with a Maltese cross in the middle of it. I mean, this
isn't
was
that
just,
yeah.
I mean, it just really, I was like, well, and then come to find out, they said also they found near Spiro there a redheaded giant buried in a mound with armor and a sword and all this stuff. And I said, okay, that's too much. I've got to go check this place out. So I went out to go check this place out, and it's in the middle of just nowhere, Oklahoma. And it took us forever to find it. Once we finally got there, it was about an hour before close. I went out, started getting footage. Guy didn't like the questions I was asking, because I was asking, why can't we see any of these artifacts that were excavated from here? There's a great book called Looting of the Spiral Mounds. People should check out for more information on that. And I was just perplexed at all of these sites, from Moundville to Spiral Mounds. You go there, and you can go read, anywhere online or anywhere the official records about the archaeological discoveries that were found in these sites. Hundreds of thousands. They found hundreds of thousands of artifacts at all these sites, but yet when you go to any of them, you can't see any of the actual artifacts that were found there. You can only see replicas. In fact, to see any of these artifacts taken from Spiro Mounds or any of these other places, especially Spiro, you have to go to the Louvre in Paris. You have to go to the top museums in England. You have to go all over the world to even catch a glimpse of this. But if you go to the actual place where they came from, there's nothing but fakes there. So they didn't like the fact that I was asking about that, and they were getting uncomfortable about it. And then this is all in the film. I saw this other spot that to me looked more like where it was located at. So after that, we're like, okay, well, let's go check out these thing called the Hevener Runestone. It was like 40 miles away from this Spiral Mound site. And also, another interesting thing, probably only about another 50 miles away from here, I would say, is where you have Tahlequah, Oklahoma, which is the seat of the Cherokee Nation. And again, those are the people that believe they were seated by Phoenicians. So only a hop, skip, and a jump from there is where you have this redhead giant skeleton being found. That's where you have this artifact with the serpent swastika, Maltese cross. And you have this thing called the Hevener Runestone. And this was really, really, I mean, I've been my whole life living in Texas. Oklahoma's not far, so I have friends and family and all that stuff up there. I've been going there my whole life. But wow, I thought I had been everywhere across Oklahoma, and we started trying to go to this Hevener Runestone Park, and it was just way out in the middle of nowhere. We finally find this thing, and I just thought it was odd that you had to go, drive up this mountain, which you see in the film. And then once you get to the park where these runestones are at, you have to descend down this long walkway 100 feet down. So somebody on this massive stone carved these strange glyphs that, in my mind, in my opinion, don't really appear to be some of them. Some of them do, some of them don't. The ones on the giant stone, to me, appear to be symbols more than they appear to be actual text and script and writing. But you have to ascend way up and then way down. And why did somebody put this here if it doesn't mean anything? And the common belief of what this Hevener Runestone says is Gnome Dal or Gloam Dal, which they say means something about the mountain or the place. So I'm in this, and I'd already done all this scaling up and scaling down, and I get down in there, and I'm filming this, and I look at this, and just this thing pops into my head and tells me to look at this differently, and so I start looking at it differently, and I had remembered reading that Dal, D-A-L, was Sanskrit for split. Mm-hmm. And so I went, well, gnome could very well mean genome. You think about how our DNA and chromosomes are, you know, you've got 3 billion. The human genome is basically made up of 3 billion bases of DNA split into 24 chromosomes. And that's when it started. I started going, wow, you know, is this trying to say something about, you know, genetic engineering, of something about splitting the genome? I mean, that's exactly what our DNA is made of. And then I go right next to it into the other little room. And the next thing I see in the other little room are these things they call the Podio runestones, which are some smaller runestones that were found in a direct line with the larger Hevener runestone. And you had five of these runestones that were found running in a direction of south to west, or northeast, I believe. Maybe it was northeast. I can't remember. It's all in the film. But essentially, they were found in a direct line. And when you go and look at these smaller runestones, they have one that says Medoc on it, which is very close to Marduk from the Sumerian lore. And then you have another one that says, for the magic and protection of Alu. Alu was the bull in ancient Mesopotamian texts, so was Marduk. He was also known as the bull. You have this magic and protection thing being thrown around. Marduk was also said to be the god of magic. And so that's, as you mentioned, that's when I started looking at this going, well, wait a second here. Whenever this stuff was discovered, whether it be by the Smithsonian, whether it be by individual researchers, it's always cross-referenced with what is known and what is known up to that point to be indigenous to that area or that particular country, and that's it. Never in any case, because, of course, the Smithsonian believes in this hard-line isolationist idea, because of that, none of the Smithsonian scientists or anybody else, pretty much for that matter, had ever thought or even considered to start cross-referencing these artifacts found in the United States with the names of things found in ancient Mesopotamian texts. And as soon as you start doing that, you start to see all sorts of correlations that cannot be a coincidence.
No, it's like, you know, you can't do that because we know that that didn't happen. So therefore, we have to exclude that that conclusion, right? That's what they think. And but yet, with the evidence presented in front of their eyes, you know, that look, this is the same as this. Why is that? There has to be a connection, right? No, it's just even if it's just on level of coincidence, it must be some kind of divinely act then or something like that. I mean, there is correlation. Come on, people.
Yeah, and again, you know, if it wasn't for the fact that you had all these other artifacts found in the same area, that also, I mean, the tablet found maybe 40 miles from these runestones that was in an ancient Iberian-Libyan text. You have a stele found in Iowa that has the predominant language that was used, the three predominant languages that were used during the time of Solomon, and that are found on a stele in Iowa. You have these places like the, what is it? It's in New Hampshire. They call it like America Stonehenge. It's actually, I talk about it in the film a little bit as well. Even on their official sign, they say that this appears to be of a Phoenician origin. You've got other sites found around the United States that have Phoenician writings on them. You have these ancient triangular tablets that I described in the film that were found in Dallas that had Phoenician letterings and skull and bones on them that were found at a depth in which they were pulling dinosaur bones out. I mean, it's just unbelievable, and you can't believe it's a coincidence when all of these roads to all of these artifacts, the Back Creek Stone as well that I talk about that has the inscription for Judea or Gudea, and then you find out Gudea was this the great ruler of that particular era of ancient Mesopotamia that the Amorites existed in, and how the Amorites were considered to be disciples of Gudea. And then we find this Back Creek Stone, the Smithsonian actually found it, in a Cherokee burial mound in Alabama under the head of a red-haired giant. And even though they found it, they tried to come back and say, oh, it's just a fake.
Yeah.
Well, if it's a fake, then why is it still kept under lock and key in a museum? You would think a fake would be, you know, thrown out to the garbage and discarded. But no, it's still kept under lock and key. It's in a college in Tennessee right now. But there's just, I mean, there's so much of it. And I didn't even scratch the surface in this film. I'm hoping that in the future volumes, I'll be able to go explore some more of the sites around the United States, get more evidence of this, and present it in more films. But it's just fascinating. And as you said earlier, this idea that what we've been told on the surface of our history and who we are is in any way, shape, or form the fact, it just starts to fall apart more and more every day as you look at the evidence.
There's just so many of these out-of-place artifacts, uparts, and
right.
It just goes on and on and on. I wonder how much we don't know, how much has been suppressed so far. But it seems to be, we have people like Barry Fell, you know, has looked into right. this. You bring up the very interesting, and let's talk about that a little bit, Burroughs Cave in Illinois.
Oh, absolutely. Burroughs Cave in Illinois is a very interesting one because this is another one of those sites where the scientific community has said, this is fake. This is absolutely fake. There's no way this is real. And when you look at the artifacts that were found there, it starts to be pretty clear why they would say this is a fake because for all intents and purposes, the things that were found at the Burroughs Cave in Illinois seem to be the, I mean, they just prove everything we've been talking about right here. I mean, you see evidence of, I mean, they've got, you know, Sumerian type things depicted on artifacts there. They've got a ancient Iberian and Libyan and Mesopotamian inscriptions there. I mean, it goes on and on. And apparently, from what I understand, the reason why you have so many of these sites that have been deemed fake is because when the Smithsonian, oftentimes what happens is people will find a discovery or they'll discover something. And, you know, they're just, Henrik, regular, everyday, for the most part, mainline people, you know, that believe everything is just okay on the surface. So they don't know any better. You know, they find these things and they go, well,
I better hand it over to the Smithsonian because they'll do a proper investigation of this thing. Nope.
Right. Yeah. It's just, it's that well-meaning, you know, people mean well, but and they just don't know the real reality of it. And so what happens is the Smithsonian comes along, they say, thank you very much. They take it and they put it under lock and key and it's never seen again. But in a few odd cases, and Burroughs Cave is definitely one of them, there are several others out there that have been found. In every case when they can't get their hands on the evidence and the people won't give it up to them, they automatically, with just a broad scope brush, just say, well, that's a fake artifact, all that's fake. And then these people can't go and get any recognition or money for what they find or anything else because the almighty Smithsonian's declaration has been that this is a fake, and who is going to challenge this Smithsonian? They're the know-all, and that's essentially the same modus operandi that they applied to Burroughs Cave and other sites that they applied to the rock wall. Yeah, you know, you would think that that something established in 1927, especially with the evidence and the way technology has progressed and the data that we have now and have attained since 1927, you would think that they would at least allow, you know, a new investigation or at least a new examination of the new evidence, but they won't. They're happy with that 1927 standing because it fits right in to what their current standpoint is, and they don't want people to get outside of that plantation of thought.
I know that you want to do as well, Josh, is to try to bring more and more focus and attention to some kind of more honest investigation being done on the rock wall, and certainly there's many other sites and places as well that this could be done on. But, I mean, you mentioned a couple of people in the 90s, most recently, like Lindsay and some others that have been looking into this, but there really hasn't been that much in excavation. We don't even it's difficult to get access to the rock wall. As you said before, most of it is still underground. Maybe there has been extensive study, but if so, this hasn't been let out to the public anyway.
Well, that's been my whole problem with all of this, and that's why I'm hoping to conduct an archaeological dig of my own at some point with the help of others out there. Is because there, I mean, I know of sites right now. I mean, I know places right now that land is for sale where there's parts of the rock wall at. But the thing about it is, we have all this information. And as I said before, I've cataloged almost all of it. I'm pretty sure all of it in the film pertained to the rock wall. But, you know, it, for some reason, Henrik, it wasn't, none of this stuff has been cataloged or documented properly, meaning, you know, when they, when the dozer started shaking from the piezoelectrical properties of the wall, like it was going to shake, take off. How come somebody didn't have video of that?
Yeah.
How come there wasn't video of that? When you had this analysis done, how come we didn't see the documentation shown on screen? I want to have a new investigation of the wall. I want to have a new archaeological dig, and I want to take all of this data and basically get it documented, high def video, high def pictures, and get this stuff collated and put together so that the public can see it for the first time and understand that it's not just what somebody is not just saying this. This is actually the facts. And so there's so much more that that we don't know yet, and I think could come out, especially now. I mean, the only map we have of this thing was done by John Lindsay by hand over the course of like 2 or 3 years, sneaking on to people's property and, you know, just taking a stick and sticking it under the ground. I mean, we have things like LIDAR, ground penetrating radar, all of this stuff now, which, of course, you know, NASA and the powers that be have access to, that we don't have access to, which we could for not a lot of money. That's the whole thing. And so that's my goal, is I want to do the first real conclusive and honest documentation of the investigation into the wall. I want to document the whole step from the first breaking ground. Nobody's actually even gone all the way down to the bottom yet, all the way down to the foundation, seven stories down. The stones get bigger the farther you go down. Nobody's done that yet. I mean, to me, whether or not you want to say this is a natural formation, or whether or not you want to believe, like the evidence says, that this is not a natural formation, regardless of that, there has not been enough investigation and enough collating of the data up to this point to justify either belief, in my opinion.
Yeah. I know so many sites around the world that are neglected. They don't have any... well, there might be a minor interest, from certain people, but of course they can't get the funding. There is very, very selected. This is happening in Sweden all the time as well. The major finds that have been done in the country is basically by people who have farmed their land and basically stumbled over the gold chains and necklaces and pottery and stuff like that in a region which is highly neglected, which is the western part of Sweden, pretty much. But at the same time, all the funding for the archaeological stuff goes on up around Stockholm, because they say this is where the cradle of Sweden is. So it's happening all over the world in the same regard. I also, when you're talking about some of this, George, I can't help to think and feel that it's connected with sites like Göbekli Tepe in Turkey, and just this idea that this is a worldwide culture, share the knowledge basically. Of both how to construct these things and maybe even the reasons why to do them for purposes of catastrophe and stuff like that. But
yeah,
let's go back to the Maltese cross again and talk about the, you know, the potential link there in that symbol and everything, because I remember watching Syrian or Assyrian symbols. There are symbols in, I think it's in Tiwanaku.
That
have on some of these pillars, they have these exact Maltese cross and everything. There seems to be a succession here which goes back to ancient times. So when we look at the symbol today and associated with the Knights Templar or the Knights of Malta, what have you, it goes way, way, way back there.
Oh, it goes way back. And you actually see depictions of this in ancient Sumerian art as well. You'll see the Maltese cross there. The one thing that stuck out to me the most, Henrik, about this was I almost subtitled this film On the Trail of the Feathered Serpent, because everywhere that I went and all the spots that I visited, there was always, it's just the feathered serpent, Quetzalcoatl, that whole thing kept coming up time and time again. And I detail a lot of that in the film as well for people to see. But then I found out that when Quetzalcoatl first came on the scene, however long back, a thousands of years ago, however it was, he came out wearing this Maltese cross. And then, of course, as you mentioned, you go further up in history and you see it later being used by, the Red Shield, Rothschild. I mean, you can go on and on and on, the Templars, on into history. But I think that to me is the greatest indicator of this ancient knowledge that originated in the first secret society, the Brotherhood of the Snake, and then stretched itself out through all these other successive mystery schools, mystery religions, and everything else. And I think that that's why that symbol has been on, you know, the swastika serpent symbol, which the swastika goes back to the Phoenicians as well. You see it again, Quetzalcoatl, Templars. It seems to be not to mention, you know, Knights of Malta and the whole Vatican thing, but sure, it seems to be this divine knowledge, this divine information at its core seems to have religious overtones to it. And this seems to be what various different religions around the world have been based on. So whether we're talking about an established religion like Christianity or Catholicism, or whether we're talking about a group like the Brotherhood of the Snake or the Templars or anything else, it really represents this divine knowledge. It really represents this ancient knowledge that of astronomy, of mathematics, of building, of culture, possibly even genetics and other high-level scientific things. And it seems to represent this idea that the small amount of people have this information, and that symbol is depicted and carried by people who seem to have or have had access to this knowledge. I mean, here's another strange, startling thing, Henrik. I mean, if you go and look at Roslyn Chapel in Scotland, there is a type of maize or corn depicted in Roslyn Chapel that wasn't known outside of America years and years later that was depicted there. So how did that get there? I mean, there's all sorts of stories of, you know, the Templars having boats and going to North America and places like that thousands of years ago. I mean, you start to see that none of this is separate. We are taught that all of this stuff is separate individual points, and the more that you research it and the farther back you go, the more that you see that the separation is an illusion. The separation is a lie. This is all the doings of a massive worldwide people who all in the beginning had their genesis in one place and one origin.
And do you think, George, that this that there is a cult today? Maybe there's just a small group of people within some of these fraternities or brotherhoods, what have you, that actually have pretty much the full picture at this stage. They know what has happened. They, for whatever reason, then keep it hidden and actually manipulate and control. Consequently, they steer the world, I would say, to a certain degree, in terms of, well, because if you hold back people from knowing where they come from, what the true origins are, there is a tremendous amount of power in that. You can set up a whole educational system that is built on lies. The psychological damage is huge on the in that regard. But the question is, if it's been preserved to a certain extent, the knowledge, and they have pieces of this picture. Do you think that's the case today?
I think it is. I mean, I think it's hard to nail it down to one particular group, because I think all the groups have pieces of this or are operating from the same viewpoint on it. I mean, just as we talked about earlier, the Native American religious traditions that were carried along and depicted in these mound sites, the alignments to these star systems that depict the travel and that the soul takes after death, that mirror Egyptian, Tibetan Book of the Dead. I mean, you start to see that, and you start, okay, well, these guys, even though they were separate and on separate parts of the world, they're playing from the same book. And I think it's the same way whether you want to talk about Freemasons or Rosicrucians or whatever group it may be. And I think certainly the groups in the modern day that have this knowledge that you're talking about here, Henrik, I think probably we don't know their names, and we probably won't even ever hear about them, because, as I said, they start new groups throughout history, but they all seem to be operating from the same standpoint, and it's all about perpetuating this system indefinitely. I mean, it's all about perpetuating this this overarching control system and keeping itself perpetuated indefinitely. And the only thing that will keep this thing from perpetuating itself indefinitely is the real truth. And when people realize that we have so much unlocked potential in ourselves, you know, we hear about, you know, ancient messianic figures having all these, you know, powers and abilities, and we don't realize that really it's an allegory for something that we all have inside of us, that the system is designed 100% to keep suppressed in us, so we never learn how to use that muscle, we never learn how to use that energy, and when we don't become a threat to them.
Well, that's right. I mean, this would blow the lid off the whole thing. And again, I think a large portion of the control system is actually structured around, as one of the points I tried to make earlier, that if you're not allowed to know the origins of both yourself, but also what you're part of, then that you're going to be a more controlled target in that regard. And something like this would open up the floodgates. It would. I mean, can you imagine the people who would like start asking questions about this? Where do we really come from? What has happened on this planet before, and why haven't we been allowed to know it? I think, I mean, it's the information has been out there for a long time, but it's still in such a small degree, and you really have to go search for it on the web, and then there's counter information to that, trying to discredit some of these people are doing through investigation, and again, just the further back in the record you go, and though some of those early researchers seem to have a whole lot of room to operate in and stuff like that. They could actually do some interesting stuff. And people like Barry Fell and some of these others I mentioned before had done some amazing connections, between the Celtic groups and how they came over to America. You had the Viking stuff or the Kensington runestone and stuff like that. So it is there, but it's difficult to get it out to the masses because of the structure of the media and everything else. But I still believe that through continued, investigation and raising awareness on these things, it will slowly catch on, because I think, the origin of what this is all about is one of the most important questions that there is, Josh.
And I think that to me, Henrik, I mean, I think that's the most important thing about my new film, is the fact that if nothing else, it is a great example and a great collection of all of these various anomalies that a lot of people may not even be aware exists. I mean, I was blown away by a lot of this stuff. I was blown away to find out that, you have mounds that were found in Syria and mounds that were found in Saudi Arabia. And these look identical to mounds that were found in Alabama.
Yeah.
That kind of thing is stuff like that, and that's been so far the response I've gotten from people back on the film so far has been that is just the sheer amount of stuff that, it's right under our noses. I mean, a lot of my listeners have gone out, and I encourage other people out there, when they hear about these sites, a lot of people, a couple of my listeners that lived near mounds their entire life. They never visited them. They never thought anything about it.
Yep, I know.
And they started hearing me talk about it, and as soon as they went out and started checking out these places, they started having, interesting experiences on their own, and you really get an idea, and that's why I really am looking forward to being able to go out into the field for further volumes of this film to gather more data, because it's something about getting out there and actually physically going to these sites and experiencing them for yourselves. I can't even explain it, Henrik. It almost gives you a verification in an almost non-material way. It's almost like when you go there and you're investigating this. I had one of my listeners tell me that she went to the Cahokia Mounds, which are in southern Illinois near St. Louis. They actually have a mound there that's bigger in its footprint than the Great Pyramid of Giza. Most people don't even know this thing exists.
Yeah.
I mean, they don't even know what's there. And she went out there, and she just had this sort of voice talking to her the whole time saying, thank you. Thank you for looking into this. Thank you for appreciating this. Because there seems to have been profound spiritual events that happened at these various sites that have embedded their energy into those sites, as you mentioned earlier. And I think that does have everything to do with why these sites were initially built on spots where they were. And, getting to the long and the short of what I think the rock wall is, I mean, I absolutely think it was one of these pre-Diluvian cities that's described in the Sumerian King List, which is found in a museum in Oxford, England, that details this 432,000 year reign of these gods over these cities prior to the flood. And when you look at how the rock wall is almost, I mean, it's almost right smack dab on the 33rd degree parallel, Dallas is. If you look at the fact that these first messianic deities like Quetzalcoatl, the first being Oannes, first showed up in ancient Iraq, ancient Babylon, right on the 33rd degree parallel after the floodwaters receded, it makes complete sense that, yes, They had their city set up on the 33rd degree parallel. The great deluge happened. It got wiped out. They went under the water for a period of time in these fish suits, as the texts talk about. And then once the waters receded, they came right back up in the exact location, right on the 33rd degree parallel again. And this is where you started to have the rise of what we now know as Sumeria, Babylon, Assyria, and that whole area. It's a fascinating thing. And these people have left their mathematics in these sites all over the world. The Newark Earthworks in Ohio is another one that is chock full of, it has its own mathematical codex. 666 is encoded into this thing several times. You've got a depiction of this. Well, the Newark Earthworks specifically depict the symbolical traveling of the soul into these other star systems and whatnot after death. And then you go and read, you know, what the Theosophists believe. Somebody like Alice Bailey, who wrote in her book Initiation, Human and Solar, that when you're a Freemason and you reach the highest levels of Freemasonry on Earth and you die, you enter into the next lodge where you're only an adept, and that lodge is located on Sirius. And this is identical to the idea that the Freemasons and the Rosicrucians have put out, and the idea of the transmigration of souls, the idea of being able to take your soul energy out of one vessel and plant it into another vessel and do that continually. And this is what you see described in ancient Mesopotamian and Egyptian texts concerning people like Thoth and many others, Enki. And it's just this continuation. The Emerald Tablets of Thoth described that as well. And I did a reading of that on my radio show that people can find at my website. And that's the thing I find over and over again. The Rosicrucians as well believe that the soul is being crucified on the body. That's what the rose and the cross represents. But it all, in the end, has to do with this idea that you can transcend this death of this physical body, and you can come back and inhabit another body again. And this is one of the deepest held, closely held secrets of the ancient society. So, as we mentioned, it doesn't matter what the groups are called now. It all goes back to that original idea that they want to keep this in secret. Because, again, as you said, if you can do that, you've got the power, and you've got the power over the people.
You know, there are many things that aren't recognized as being ancient sites or mounds as well, but you can actually see it after a while. You can train. Yep. and see it. I've been going around in the last couple of years in different places around in Western Sweden primarily, and there are tons of sites, hundreds of raised stones and mounds and these burial shafts or whatever it's called in English. And we have one mound that's close that have standing stones on top of it. And they're really? All around you. Yeah, they're all around up there. And I think that it's the same around the world. This is something we never heard, hardly hear about in school when we're young. We didn't anyway. It's a neglect of the cultural heritage, or at least they're not recognizing it and don't giving you the facts of what the area is where you're born in. But when you visit the sites, you if they are recognized, usually there's plaques there that allegedly tell you everything about the sites, right? But I'd say go and check out the site first and get a sense of it and feel it before you are programmed with what it's supposed to be by these, right, government-sponsored plaques that's on there. And right. I just want to mention one website as well that people can go to check out. It's actually the Megalithic Portal, and they have links to, I think it's primarily in the UK and England, of course, but it's yes. in Europe, it's around the rest of the world as well. And I think people can even submit there. So if you go out and find stuff, you can actually submit it there to this database. It's megalithic.co.uk, the Megalithic Portal. So I urge everyone to check that out and see what's close in your area. And if it's not on there, report it so we can know about it.
Well, I think that's very important. And what I found startling was that when you had the beginnings of colonial America and you had people coming east to west, settling, people often, have wondered why is it that they chose the spot where they built New York City at, or Dallas? At? Oh, why yeah. didn't they build it 50, mm-hmm. 50 miles up the road? Why didn't they build it 100 miles up the road? It's because when they started coming across, they found existing cities, mounds, in all of these cities. I mean, Philadelphia had a ton of mounds that were covered. I mean, there were literally hundreds of thousands, in the hundreds of thousands, upwards of, I think I've heard, 900,000 earthworks and mounds found in the United States alone in the early days, and most of which have been bulldozed and destroyed and built on top of, with a scant few left that have been made parks out of. And as we talked about earlier, I think the only reason that they saved some of these sites is because there is something there that they want to use for their own purposes and their own devices. But there's no question that we haven't even scratched the surface. Another one of the goals of this film, besides being able to have archaeological digs and stuff, is to, as you mentioned, to get that awareness up. Because, you know, when I first started finding out about the mounds, I started to see them everywhere I went, in places I've been going my whole life,
I know,
and never even noticed it when it's right there under your nose. And that's another one of the key things about all this, is hiding it in plain sight.
That's right. You see the shape of it, and usually, at least in Sweden, I don't know how it is in Texas, but there's you know, a large set of older oaks or something like that growing out of it, and you can you see the shape of it. It has to be something right here. And
I'll tell you where that's prevalent at a lot, Henrik, in the United States, is Georgia and Virginia. That's where you see that type of thing a lot.
Yeah, see, and there's something going on there. And again, as you said, Josh, it doesn't mean automatically that it's a grave site. I mean, again, we have sites in Sweden where it says this is a burial site, it's believed, but we've never dug in there, so we don't know anything, but it's believed to be a burial site. You know, it could be anything impossible, you know, that's in there.
Could be a giant in there.
Yeah. It has something to do with probably the properties of the land, though, that it's a node point in the Earth energy field or something like that, and they've probably done it to magnify or symbolically you know, make a visual representation of that thing. And then there was probably all kinds of stuff that was used for ritual purposes, council sites. There's all kinds of ideas there, but it's really
cool. Well, here's another interesting thing, Henrik, that I found out too. A lot of the mound sites initially that were found in the United States, a lot of the famous founding fathers, Thomas Jefferson.
Yeah.
He had mounds all on his plantation that he excavated. George Washington had a lot on his as well. And that wasn't just with founding fathers and stuff. You started to find that where these rich white aristocrats in the colonial days were setting up their giant plantations, they would always set them up on these spots that had these mounds and whatnot on them. And I think that that had probably, as you said, has everything to do with the frequency of this. And the area in Rockwall where you have, and this is no joke, you can look at the map, the rock wall actually has the Pythagorean theorem built into the structure of it. And the area in rock wall where the Pythagorean theorem is built into the wall, that area of houses over there, Henrik, I can't even get to get footage of, because it's all gated communities, because those houses over there run in excess of $20 to $50 million.
Yeah,
the richest houses in rock wall are built on these structures. And I've talked to listeners of mine who have described having family members who live in that area and going to the house for vacation, and an overwhelming calm, overwhelming just feeling, you know, very good and feeling so good when you're there. And there has to be, as you mentioned, this energy vortex. I think, as I mentioned earlier with the missing time, the UFO sightings, the energy force, I think that has everything to do with this strong electromagnetic signature that is left behind residually in this crystal and stone in the wall, and that this also is what is giving this soothing, calming feeling, because crystals can do that. I mean, if you take crystals and you take big ones and you build yourself a house and you build them into the foundations of your house, you will have a calm, positive vibe and feeling in your house because of the energy that these stones and these crystals put out themselves. And I think that the builders knew this, and probably the stonemasons and whatnot that constructed these expensive properties knew that as well.
Interesting. We talked with Richard Hoagland a little bit. He talked about some of the houses that was in and around the Chichen Itza area there in the Yucatan. And he talked about also there allegedly being data for them being, they lived longer, those who are inside of the perimeter of, you know, where this field affects people, basically. And those on the outside actually only lived half as long. And oh, as well, I want to mention you mentioned Thomas Jefferson, his Monticello, the plantation house, whatever it's called. Check out some of Kurt Lindahl's work. He has done some great stuff on that, how it relates to other sites and stuff like that. So it's, there's definitely something to it.
Yeah, absolutely. And Kurt's a great researcher. He actually contacted me after the last time I was on here with you, Henrik. And he definitely has a lot of stuff that ties in with all of this that I hope we'll get to eventually to tie all this together. But as I stated before, I mean, nobody else has made a film on this Rockwall thing up to this point except me. I felt this. I don't know, just almost like a calling, like it was something I was meant to do this. And so this is by no means this first film, even though it's 3 hours and 34 minutes, it's by no means the definitive investigation. It's by no means a closed book. And I'm hoping that this will, inspire other people who are interested in this to want to come forward and help out the cause and help out the our ability in getting a lot of this accomplished. Because, I mean, the evidence shows beyond any shadow of a doubt that it definitely brings up more questions than answers. And I think that's the one thing that should always drive you. When you start to see, when you dig this deep into something, as I digged in with this film, and in the end of it, after making a 3-hour and 34-minute film, you have more questions than answers.
Oh, sure.
It's a pretty good sign.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, it's great. We're going to round things up here in a little bit. I want to thank you for your work, Josh, and urge you to keep it up, of course. And I want to urge everyone out there listening to get a copy of Josh's film and support him so that he can continue doing the work that he's doing and proceed in, second, third, and so on volumes of this, because it's really interesting stuff. And if you're interested in this stuff, what we've been talking about, do get a hold of a copy. Please, again, Josh, give us the website. And if there's anything else, by the way, you want to mention before we wrap things up here for this time.
Okay. It's theglobalreality.com. That's theglobalreality.com. You can also go to Google and just type Josh Reeves, and my website will be the first one that comes up. People can go there and they can get digital downloads. They can also buy the discs. We'll have that up pretty soon as well, hopefully by the time people hear this. You can also go to my website and make a donation if you want. I want to be clear, I'm just a regular guy, and everything I do comes from donations from people out there who are like me and you and want to change this stuff and know that the Smithsonian and the powers that be are not going to do this for us, and we have to do this ourselves. And I couldn't be here and couldn't have done all this without all the great people out there who donated and supported my work. Henrik is just a big supporter of my work and has helped me out a great deal. This guy doesn't just talk the talk, folks. He walks the walk, and he really tries to help out fellow researchers and people like me, and I just commend him so much for it. And, anything that people can do to help this out, whether they want to help finance a dig or whether they just want to help finance the next film, any of that goes towards this cause. And I believe wholeheartedly that once people see this film for themselves, they're definitely going to have an interest in this, like you and I, Henrik. And I'm just totally excited about what the future holds and can't wait to be back up here to talk to you again, my friend.
Sounds good. Thank you so much for that, Josh. Website again, theglobalreality.com. It's very exciting stuff, and I do hope you keep it up, Josh. We'll talk more soon.
Okay, thank you so much.
Thank you, dear listeners, for your time and for your interest. We appreciate your support, and we will be back with much more soon. My special thanks to Fredrik, Lana, and Elizabeth. Have a good day, and take it easy.